Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Recuperación de Jorginho, otra más. Ahí está Martin Odegaard regateando en una baldosa. Mete el pase para Jorginho, gana línea de fondo, la pone abajo. La puso Jorginho, que ganó línea de fondo, pelota abajo para que Kai Havertz. Brighton and Hove Albion 0, Arsenal 2.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly afternoon to you, even though your afternoon has only just begun and mine is just about ending.
I think probably by the time most people are listening, it might well be the afternoon, mightn't it? Well, yeah. It might be tomorrow morning. Just goodly greeting to you, wherever you may be.
Wherever you may be. You're in Philadelphia.
I'm in Philadelphia.
Well, all I can say is, g'day, mate. Because as they say, Philadelphia is the Australia of America. Did you know that?
Is that true?
No.
The Australia of America. I'm trying to think what would be Australian about it.
I don't know. All the brotherly love, I guess.
Yeah, speaking of Australian accents, I heard in the street yesterday, the streets of Philadelphia, an Australian accent shouting out, "Let's do this!" what would that be in an Australian accent? "Let's do this!" Something like that.
Something like that.
Something like that.
I've already offended all of Australia or all of Philadelphia at this point, so I feel like I should just
keep
quiet. It's
fine, yeah, exactly. None of them are listening by now. But anyway, that was an Arsenal fan called Christine who has flown to Philadelphia from Sydney, like me, for the spectacle that is WrestleMania weekend.
So, wow.
Yeah, so you can't escape Let's Do This wherever you go. It's the moral of the story.
There is no escape. And how is or has been the wrestling?
The wrestling's been great. I've had a really fun time. I've been thinking about it because someone actually asked me this weekend, a friend of mine, Scott, said, "Why don't you do a podcast about wrestling? You know, you're really into it." Mm. And I was like, because I have to have one thing that I don't try and turn into a job. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. WrestleCast Extra, we're keeping that on the shelves.
Yeah, maybe for the patrons, we'll see, you know. But no, I think it's really nice to have to have stuff that generally takes you away from your day-to-day. But I still have found time to watch a couple of football matches out here, including one that just finished.
Oh, my goodness.
Manchester United 2, Liverpool 2.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I was watching this. I don't – look – we watch a lot of football. We talk about football. We write about football. We think we understand football. I don't know that that's true. I don't. You're like, all the things you think you know about football just can go out the window in a particular game or a particular performance. Like, how Manchester United got anything out of that game is it defies explanation and logic and statistics and all the things that we use to try and understand the game. Liverpool, what was the final? I'm just going to get it up here because I had a text from my brother, the Liverpool fan, of course, the mug smasher. He said, a fucking shit show. Darwin is dead to me. But
wow, that was a hell of a moment. Did you see that? Where they broke up the end of the pitch and played it to Darwin, and he had the choice of shooting or just tucking it back. I think it was to Szoboszlai, and he just kind of scuffed it.
Like, whiffed it across.
Did neither of those things.
Oh, my God. And even that Luis Diaz miss right at the end, whether, you know, they would have chalked it off for the so-called push on Antony, we'll never know. But he put that over the bar. But anyway, XG in this game, Manchester United 0.87, which seems about 0.86 too much based on what I saw anyway, to Liverpool's 3.92, and it ends 2-2. And obviously, this is a very fucking good result for Arsenal.
It is. I hoped for this, but seeing how United were playing, some of that hope dissipated. But like you say, I think it does defy logic a little bit, and results can in the Premier League, and particularly results in certain games. You know, it's great for us, and it keeps us top of the table on that beautiful goal difference we've built up. But I also think it's a good reminder. You know, logically, Arsenal are certainly good enough to win all their remaining games, but logic doesn't always carry,
no.
Particularly in fixtures with rivalry and history. You know, I'm delighted that Liverpool have dropped points at Old Trafford today, but I take nothing for granted when we go to that ground either, because strange things can happen, as we have just seen.
Yes, of course. And, you know, there is a North London derby as well. The form going out the window, et cetera, with derbies and all that, you know. But I think from the weekend that we've just had, we have to say it's a pretty positive one. Manchester City beat Crystal Palace in the early game on Saturday. I don't know that anyone was really holding out any hope that that result would go any other way. It put Manchester City above us. We had to hope that Manchester United could take something off Liverpool. Could have been, you know, 3 points apart from that, like, ridiculous challenge by Aaron Wan-Bissaka in the box to give Liverpool a penalty. But 2-2 is good. It means Liverpool have dropped a couple of points. It means we stay top of the table as it stands. It is, with X amount of games to go. Is it 8 now or 9? 8?
8, yeah.
8.
I mean, you said, I think, on our last show that you felt the title winner might have to win 8 of the last 9.
Mm.
So that now gives Liverpool zero margin for error.
Assuming that, like, what I say is actual, you know, stone cold facts and the truth.
Hang on, am I wrong about that? Well, everyone's played 31. So there's 38 in the season. So there's actually only 7 left.
Oh, Jesus. Right? Jesus. We're right in the business end of things right now. Aren't we? Holy crap.
It's that weird thing where it's kind of in our hands. You know, it's tempting to say, well, if we win those 7 games, we're champions. But it's always possible that Man City could beat someone about 14-0. They're a point behind.
They're a point behind, yeah, you see. So
it's fascinating, isn't it? You know, a week ago, we talked about the game at the Etihad, and there was a bit of criticism of Arsenal, I think, in the media. You know, was it an opportunity passed up? But 7 days on from that, we sit at the top of the table. And I think it does change the complexion slightly of that result. I mean, I know we said it was a good result, but I think it looks a very good result right now, because it's helped put Arsenal in the driving seat.
Yeah, for sure. You know, no team has won more games than Arsenal. No team has scored more goals than Arsenal. No team has conceded fewer goals than Arsenal. No team has a better goal difference than Arsenal. So, you know, we're in a really, really good position with 7 games to go. And we're there.
We've been the best team so far, Andrew. 31 games. I know there's no trophies for that.
No, come on. There should be. The 31 game title is ours.
I nearly said it yesterday, and I thought, well, Liverpool might go and win, and, you know, that tweet will have a very short lifespan. But we can say confidently right now, I think, most games won, most goals scored, least conceded. We have been the best. We just have to continue to be the best.
Well, that's it. Just seven more games at the, you know, the pressure point of the season with Champions League football in there as well. Look, you wouldn't swap it for anything, would you? You wouldn't. This is where you want to be. This is where everyone wants us to be. And, you know, part of why it's so exciting is just what's at stake and whether or not we can continue to do it. I think
I might swap for Man City's fixtures if it's available. No, but apart from that.
No, unfortunately not. We've got to just do what we've got to do. So, yeah. But I do think if we are looking for a bit more encouragement, a bit more, what's the word? Not comfort, but like, I think yesterday's game was something. Could we say, would I be wrong in saying that this is very much verging in the Amy Lawrence fuck off win territory? Like, it wasn't, you know, in terms of how a game goes, sometimes it can be a bit more of a statement. But I think when you look at our record against Brighton, you look at how difficult Brighton are to play against, regardless of the fact they've been a bit inconsistent so far this season in the Premier League, they're still a really difficult team to beat. I think when you look at the chances Arsenal had in this game, what they restricted Brighton to in this game, the XG, the way we were able to manage and control this game after we went 2-0 up, all of it smacked of a team that is like 100% in control of what it is doing, confidence, the technical, all of it is there. I think this was a very, very significant win for Arsenal yesterday, because I guarantee you Liverpool fans and Manchester City fans were looking at that going, Arsenal have, you know, a bit of a patchy record against Brighton. It's away from home. They had a game in midweek. They've got Bayern coming up. They could be a bit, you know, a bit distracted by that. And there's no question that we were the better team and no question that we deserved to win this game. So as another way of copper fastening our title credentials, I think yesterday was really big.
It was. I mean, you touched on it there, but the question I found myself asking at full time was, how would I feel if I was a City fan or a Liverpool fan watching that game? You know, having tuned in, thinking, like you said, maybe a chance of an upset or certainly some drop points, one of Arsenal's harder games in what remains of the season, to see how assured we looked, I think would have been really disheartening. And I love that.
Mm.
And I think you're right. It's a big win. But also what I loved about it is, in a funny way, it didn't look or feel like it. Like, at full time, you know, there wasn't like a ton of emotion.
Sure.
And I don't want to sound like Gary Neville. I don't want to be the celebration police, but I did love the kind of business-like demeanor from before the game until they disappeared into the tunnel at the end of the game.
Yeah.
They came to do a job. They executed that job brilliantly, and they're on to the next one. And that, as a mentality in a run-in, is exactly what you need.
Well, I think that, you know, that is as well, you know, a consequence of what we did and how we did it. I think if we win that goal with a 91st-minute header or something, then, you know, you're going to have a different kind of celebration, which is understandable. It is the context of the game. But I absolutely agree with you. I think there's so much to unpack from the performance and what we were able to do, how we were able to change things around again. You know, Bukayo Saka came back in. Declan Rice came back in. Gabriel Jesus came back in. Jorginho came back into the team, you know, from the one that had beaten Luton in midweek. And, you know, there is this... You have to be aware of what Brighton are capable of doing and what Brighton want to do. So the way Arsenal decided to play against Brighton, as we did in the first game in the season at the Emirates, was to press really high, commit men forward, disrupt their build-up, because what they want to do is sort of invite you on a little bit and then play it through you and get in behind. But Arsenal's plan, which was evident in the first game, was evident in this game, was to commit men forward and really commit men forward. And there is a risk-reward element in that, isn't there? Because, you know, there were a couple of moments, I think, when Brighton did play through very early on, maybe it was about 9 or 10 minutes in, they produced a really, really nice move down the right-hand side, their right-hand side. It ended up with Enciso shooting over from just outside the box. But it was a lovely piece of play from Brighton. Nice football. I think if Arsenal had produced that, people would be waxing lyrical about the passing and the moving and all the rest. But, you know, we had, before that, had chances. The Gabriel header, there was maybe the Bukayo Saka chance. Was it just before, just after that? I can't quite remember. But you have to be brave, and you have to trust that the defensive structures you have in this team are capable of recovering and doing the work you need to do if you commit men forward against Brighton, because they do have the ability to hurt you. And I think that approach that we've taken against Brighton in both these games is, I think it's an example of Mikel Arteta learning from previous games against Brighton.
Absolutely. And having to be proactive and accepting that they're going to go man-to-man in some situations, and that we feel we can match them. We can best them in a man-to-man environment. I did think that particular move was an interesting one, because if there was a question over the starting lineup, or a debate rather, it did seem to be about left-back spot. You know, I saw a lot of people worrying maybe about Zinchenko being in there, and they kind of blew past him in that particular move, as I recall.
I think they would have blown past Kivior or Tomiyasu as well. I'm not making any excuse, or I just think sometimes you have to take your hat off to a nice piece of football. I don't think that was to do with Zinchenko at all.
Well, and I don't think, like you say, I think, was it Lamptey who's playing on the right-hand side? Mm. I mean, he absolutely flew beyond him, and he will fly beyond a lot of players. I only bring it up really because I think that actually, you know, obviously I keep an eye on social media, and there's been quite a lot of criticism I've noticed of Zinchenko. And I do wonder if that particular move, or that particular moment, has maybe had a kind of outsized impact on the discussion and the dissection of his performance. Mm. I wonder if it kind of, triggered some of our fears and insecurities about the team. But actually, I thought, you know, after that moment, he was pretty competent.
Now, I do think the early stages of this game were quite interesting. You probably didn't see Mikel Arteta's post-game interview on Sky Sports. Mm. And what he said was, at one point, he said Brighton had set up a little bit differently than we had expected. Mm. So maybe in those opening periods, or the opening minutes of the game, we were a little bit more exposed to Brighton at that point, I think, than any other point in the game. I know there was that chance late in the half, which we'll come to for Enciso, but that was more a piece of individual play. But there was a moment, I think, you could see that Carlos Cuesta was talking to Arteta, and he was talking about getting a ball over the top and into the left-hand channel. By the 11th minute, Bukayo Saka hadn't had a touch in the game. So I think Arsenal had to adjust a little bit tactically. But then there was this period, you know, he had that early Gabriel chance, which, you know, I think everyone would have expected him to score that, given how good he is. But there were maybe three chances in fairly close succession. There was the Saka chance when Jorginho played in white to Saka. He came back on his left foot, and I couldn't quite believe that ball went wide, to be honest.
No. He did everything right, didn't he, apart from the finish. And actually, when I watched the replay, it looked even closer than it looked in real time. I think I thought he'd really made a hash of it, but yeah. I think he just bent it past the post. That was the Saka of the December period, where we couldn't score any goals, I think, in that particular instance.
Yeah, he'll be
know he let one
penalty.
Go there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's capable of better. There was the Jesus chance then, set up by Saka from the edge of the box. There's I don't know if you've watched that again, but there's a really funny moment where Ben White goes charging into the box. I think it's Pascal Gross grabs him and Ben White goes falling over in proper Ben White style. We're all distracted by the fact that Gabriel Jesus had a shot on target and the keeper pushed it away for a good save. And then there was Kai Havertz with a cross at the back post to Gabriel Jesus. He was trying to head it back across goal, but headed too far back across and wide. And you're kind of thinking, you know, these are big chances. It reminded me a little of the first game against Brighton this season where we dominated, we had the chances. Ultimately, of course, we ended up winning that game as well. But you're sort of, we have to take one of these sooner rather than later.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that Jesus header and thinking like, oh, that felt like quite a good opportunity to either, you know, find another player or try and knock it back into the far post. And 15 minutes into the game, you're starting to think, well, I suppose look at the Liverpool game. We're just talking about missed chances can cost you,
yeah,
right? And we know that from painful experience earlier on in the season. We've been much better in terms of getting that early breakthrough and taking our opportunities when they come. So I did start to worry a little bit, but fortunately, we didn't have to wait too long for the breakthrough.
No, the penalty came in, what was it, the 31st minute, something like that. Ball out to Jesus on the left-hand side, drives into the box. I know that Lamptey gets a tiny, tiny touch on the ball, but, you know, it's a foul. Because he does prevent Jesus from, you know, collecting that ball if he goes on. I know my brother, and I'm sure fans of Liverpool and Manchester City were going, he got the ball, can't be a penalty, shouldn't be a penalty, VAR should overturn that. But that is absolutely a stonewall penalty. You know, Roberto De Zerbi afterwards said, it's a clear penalty. And this is a man who literally went on his press conference to talk about how he hates 80% of the referees. So I think if there was any chance whatsoever for him to have a go at the ref over that decision, he would have.
Do we know that he wasn't saying it in a sort of facetious Pep Guardiola sarcasm manner?
I don't think he was.
Okay. Well, he's right in that case. It is an absolute stick-on penalty. You know, I was watching the game in a bar. I'll tell more of that story anon. But I couldn't believe they kept showing replays of it because I was like, wow, the commentators must be debating if this is a penalty. And I think Lee Dixon, who was on colour commentary, I heard later maybe suggested he didn't think it should have stood.
We had a lot of questions about Lee Dixon, apparently talking about this for about 20 minutes, it wasn't
that
a penalty.
Makes sense.
I don't understand how anyone can look at that and not think it's a penalty. I just don't.
I know it's like a defender's bias.
Exactly. Former defender. I got a tiny bit of the ball. That then negates, you know, the fact I clattered the man. Maybe you get away with that in the old days. But, you know, in the old days, the referee wouldn't even see that touch on the ball. We could only see that touch on the ball because we got a sort of super slow-mo replay of it. There's just no way that that's not a penalty.
Well, the funny thing is, I had the opposite experience to Lee Dixon in that in real time, I kind of said, I'm not sure that is a pen because I saw the ball divert, right? So I thought, oh, he might have just got a foot to it. But then when you see the replay and you're like, well, he does get a foot to it, but he trips the guy up and effectively impedes his progress, it's a clear as day foul.
Yes.
If it was given against us, I like to think that I would also say, I'm afraid, that is a penalty.
100% is. If, you know, as much as I love our defenders, if one of them did that in the box, I don't think we could have any complaints if the ref pointed to the spot, you know?
And so let me ask you, did Martin Odegaard's little fake out fool you? Do you ever think, maybe Odegaard is going to take this one? Or do you always know it's a ruse?
I didn't know. I mean, actually, I was sort of doing the live blog and all I saw was while VAR was checking, I saw Bukayo Saka with the ball in his hands.
Right.
Did Odegaard take it first?
Yeah, he was there for a long time.
Right.
All through Lee Dixon's monologue, you know, holding the ball and shaping to take it. The old switcheroo.
Yeah. They do that a bit, actually. They do that a bit. But I think it is pretty clear that that Saka is the first choice. And unless Saka's not feeling like it or feeling confident, or if it's the second penalty in the game to sort of just confuse the goalkeeper a bit, they might change over. But I always feel like Saka's going to take it, and I felt pretty confident that Saka was going to score this.
To be honest, I think given the chance he missed 12 minutes into the game, I think he would have been especially hungry to take it and make sure he got his goal. And, you know, we've spoken about Saka and penalties a few times. I thought this was a really good, emphatic penalty. I think even if the keeper goes the right way, I don't think he's saving that one.
No, not at all. He did his best to put him off. But he went the wrong way. And Bukayo Saka, let me just look at his penalty stats now. It is 11 scored and only 2 missed. One of those that he missed was in a penalty shootout for England under 21s.
Yes, I vaguely remember it, Andrew.
No, England under 18s, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they don't count shootouts, I guess, in those stats.
Against the Czech Republic.
Wow.
This is what I'm gleaning from Transfermarkt, by the way.
They're always right, Andrew, especially about transfer values and stuff. When it's Saka, 100% accurate.
Saka was playing at left back that day for England. So there you go.
Another time, another world.
Different times. So, Arsenal in the lead. The Brighton fans were not happy with the referee, which I found quite funny, to be honest.
They weren't happy with Gabriel Jesus either, were they, from what
They weren't happy with Ben White at one point. They're probably not very happy with Leandro Trossard right now. We'll come to that, of course. Big moment, though, just before the break when Enciso, I think he wiggled away. It was wiggled away from Saka a couple of times, got off a good shot. And David Raya doesn't have to make a lot of saves these days, but he did make a very good one here to ensure that we took the lead into the break.
Yes, the lesser-spotted David Raya save. But this was an excellent one. You know, good reach. And wasn't dissimilar, was it, to the Porto goal that beat him in Portugal? But, you know, I think he learnt from that and made a really good stop here.
Yes, he really did. Second half, there were chances. There was an early one, wasn't there, for Gabriel Jesus, where Havertz stood the ball up to the back post. He headed down into the ground. There was an Odegaard shot, which the keeper sort of swiped at a bit. It seemed to come off his wrists and go just over the bar. Mm-hmm. Remember that one?
I do.
And I was thinking, you know, at that point in the game, because it was a bit stretched at times because of how high we were put, there was space in midfield for both teams. And I was thinking to myself, and I think I said it on the live blog, I just wonder if we might need to get some more legs into midfield. And by that, I meant, you know, maybe drop Declan Rice back, maybe put on someone like Emile Smith Rowe in the eight position, you know, just to sort of shore things up a little bit. But Rice was doing a very specific role, and I think Mikel Arteta wanted him to do that because he's got the stamina, doesn't he, to sort of play box to box and chase back and everything else. But then Jorginho, whose legs I was worried about, I have to say, pops up in a position where you don't normally expect Jorginho to be, provides a cross, and Kai Havertz is there to make it 2-0.
Absolutely, yeah. I didn't have money on Jorginho making the kind of overlapping little behind to set up a goal for Kai Havertz, but really nicely worked goal, and I liked Havertz's run as well, a little prodded finish at the near post.
It's a clever run, actually, because he goes to go in front of Dunk first and then zips in behind him. He gave Dunk Giroudian,
yes, good. In terms of his kind of movement and getting into that near post area, that's what you want from your centre forward. And I mean, I was texting you about this a bit last night, but Kai Havertz, he is this team's centre forward right now. Mikel Arteta said sometimes the players decide, you know, where they want to play. And I think he means that not necessarily in a literal sense of they tell you, but you find a chemistry and something clicks, and it's clicking for him right now.
Oh, it certainly is. You know, we're talking about him now, so we might as well give him his flowers, because I think this was by some distance his best game for the club. And I think he's had some good games. I think he's been very good recently. I think maybe some of the struggles early on were a little over-egged. We had worries about him. We had some concerns about him. I don't think it's unfair to say that, but he has come good. He's really become integral to the team. I think, you know, one of the things that we did say when the goals weren't coming, when the assists weren't coming, was that he is doing things for the team that Mikel Arteta would appreciate, right? That maybe as, you know, as a fan, you're sort of like, well, if he's not scoring and he's not providing assists and he's playing in that position, what is he doing? And I think we did make the point that there are elements to his game that Arteta would appreciate, even if it's difficult for fans to not see or to not care too much about, right? Because ultimately it is goals and assists that people judge players on, rightly, wrongly, or somewhere in between. That is how they do it. But I think this was, in an all-round performance, absolutely superb from him, because he worked hard defensively. There were moments he was back in the right-back position, chasing back. He was in our box, making clearances. He's making those runs throughout the game. I think was it Baliba who got booked at one point because Havertz was just making a run and he dragged him down. This was in the second half. He was winning aerials. He, you know, was holding it up well. He was making chances for others. He scored a goal, ultimately got an assist to his name as well. I think this was like just a really, really, really impressive performance from Havertz yesterday. And, you know, it is, I think, as we also said, the ideal situation, regardless of whatever concerns or doubts people had, the best possible outcome for all of us was that Kai Havertz would come good. And I think we're seeing that right now.
Certainly. This was up there with the finest of Marouane Chamakh performances.
Oh,
Andrew.
Jesus. Damned with faint praise there, James.
Right out of the top drawer of Chamakh's style. honestly, at times, if I closed my eyes, I could believe it was Marouane himself. Really extraordinary. Now, he was very good. I'm taking the mickey.
I know.
But he... I'm someone who's often accused of being a bit moderate or sitting on the fence or, you know, not maybe taking strong lines on stuff. But I really, really firmly believe his best position is as a centre forward. And I have said that pretty much from the start. And what's happened in the last few months has absolutely convinced me of that. I think it's better for him, but I also think it's better for us, in that I think we look a better team with him as a focal point. I think we look a better team with two proper midfield players in there, in Rice and Jorginho. I think as transformative as Havertz has been in the front line, I think that is in some ways the real transformation in this team, how we've changed the engine room to accommodate, you know, an extra proper midfielder. I always felt like Havertz looked like a bit of a square peg in a round hole in midfield. And there were times where that was useful because it added kind of an element of unpredictability. And I think it was difficult for opponents to prepare for and deal with. And I'm not saying it will never happen again, or there won't be times or periods in games when it is appropriate. But I think this is a guy who is best as a kind of nine. And I think it's probably been a period of time, not only for Mikel Arteta to, as he gets to know the player more and more, working with him day in, day out to realise that, but maybe for Havertz himself to embrace it. I think that it went so badly for him at times at Chelsea, and he was so isolated and unhappy playing as a centre forward, that I think it's almost taken him 6 months to kind of find a joy and a comfort and a confidence in that position again. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to see him doing it now.
Yeah, he was brilliant. He really was brilliant, and absolutely deserved his Man of the Match award. We'll talk a bit more about him in part two, because I do have a question about that. But Brighton made subs as soon as it went to 2-0. They brought on Buonanotte and João Pedro for Moderen and Ciso. Saka and Jesus came off. Trossard and Martinelli came on. I thought what happened after the game went to 2-0 was absolutely fascinating. Afterwards on Sky, De Zerbi said, we played quite well. We had a couple of chances. They got their goal. As soon as it went 2-0, the game was... He paused for a moment and then said, finished. But when you look at what happened and how it happened, I think it's just so instructive about what this team is capable of and what this team feels confident in doing. Mm-hmm. Remember, we spoke last week about the Man City game and how maybe if we get Man City in the Champions League semifinals, if we get there, the display, the performance at the Etihad might be useful for us, you know, to cope with those games and the pressure of those games. Like, we're not taking anything for granted. We still got a lot to do to get through against Bayern. But if the team could take confidence and belief from that game, then it might be useful if we have to play City in the Champions League semi-final.
Absolutely.
I think when we went to 2-0 against Brighton, we just thought, right, we will hold them at bay. We were like a big, tall, grown-up man holding a small child on his forehead as he was trying his best to swing punches and he just couldn't get anywhere near us. Brighton had 80... I looked this up earlier on. Brighton had 81%, 82% possession. As soon as it went 2-0, between the 2-0 goal and the end of the game, Brighton had 82% possession. In that time, Brighton had one attempt on goal. Arsenal had six.
Wow.
And the comfort and... I'm not going to say it was easy to do what we did, but this team is so well-drilled defensively, organizationally. The discipline is there. You know... The discipline and the work rate, right? I think sometimes we take things for granted a little bit. They showed a little bit of this on Match of the Day last night. Players tracking back and winning tackles. Ian Wright highlighted one that Trossard did. But there was one where Rice got bypassed in midfield because he was pressing high up, because that's what he was instructed to do. Baliba ran past him and Gabriel Martinelli chased all the way back, won a tackle, won the ball. I can't remember exactly what happened, but stopped Brighton coming forward. So even when they did find space, the awareness and the sort of the understanding that, you know, Martinelli sees Rice, uh-oh, he's not catching him because it's the 80-something minute. He doesn't have the legs to catch this guy at this point because he's been running up and down all day. I'll get back and give him a hand. They're so switched on. They just made it impossible for Brighton to get anywhere near our goal or even fashion a chance that a couple of free kicks didn't do anything with them. You know, it was so impressive, I have to say, because I felt, I don't know how you felt, but I felt really assured that they just weren't going to get a chance. They weren't going to score a goal because of how well we're capable of doing this.
I agree. And I think the quality of substitutes we're able to bring on as well at this point in the season makes a massive difference, you know, at times when legs might be tiring. You know, we changed a lot of the attackers yesterday to make sure that, you know, we could still cover that ground, we could still close people down, we could still, you know, execute the press if needed. We brought on Takehiro Tomiyasu, one of maybe the best one-to-one defender in the squad. So be it to the luxury of being able to do that and just shut down one flank, essentially, is really something. I mean, you know, we had Jakub Kivior and Thomas Partey on the bench yesterday and didn't feel the need to use them.
Yeah.
And still got the clean sheet. I also think as well, it's really evident in the conduct of the players, but there must be conversations in that dressing room, whether instigated by the manager or senior players, about the goal difference. I think they are acutely aware of how important that is. And you saw that in the reaction of, let's say, Gabriel after that that late block.
Well, it wasn't just Gabriel, was it? It was like who was in there with him. It was Trossard. It was Jorginho. You know, the players are back there. They're defending as Brighton try to make a chance. Gabriel makes the block, but like our left wingers in there, our central midfielder is in there, and they celebrated that block as much as Gabriel did. And I think that is, whether it's to do with goal difference or whether it's the mentality of the team, could be a little from column A, a little from column B, that they begrudge the opposition anything, even in a game that was already won, because at that point it was 3-0 and it would have just been a consolation. It wouldn't have been a lifeline. It would have just been a simple consolation goal, but they begrudge them even that. And I have to say, I fucking love that.
Yeah. Clean sheets are a culture and everyone has to buy into it. You know, every player has to desperately want to maintain that. And, you know, naturally centre-halves do and naturally goalkeepers do. But you're right to mention someone like Trossard who's come off the bench. It matters to him.
Mm.
It matters to all of them. They have pride in that defensive record. And when that starts to go, things can slip. And it's, you know, but when you're on a good run, you're maintaining it. You know, it's three clean sheets in the space of a week, right? And I think you talked about this maybe on the Arsecast, but it's like that Rob Edwards quote from his post-match press conference after the Luton game. They give you nothing.
Mm.
And we are a pretty mean-spirited team right now, but I'm very much enjoying it.
Is it five clean sheets in a row away from home in the Premier League? I think it is.
I think so,
something like that, you know?
I mean, David Raya, you know, I've spoken about, I think we've been the best team and we've got to maintain it. But if we maintain this level of performance, he's going to win the Golden Glove.
Yeah.
With the help of some of his performances at Brentford as well. I think he might have a clean sheet or two from that period too. But that just tells you like how well he's done and how well the defence have protected him.
Yeah.
And it's not just the defence. It's the entire team.
No, it sure is. I don't know which podcast I said it on because I've done so many podcasts over the last little while because I've had so many games. But like, if he does win the Golden Glove, he needs to give a finger each to the other defenders.
Melt it down, I think.
Yeah.
Cast everyone a little golden ring.
A little golden finger.
A little finger, yeah, finger. Just like, you know, like holy relics, like bits of a hand cast in gold.
Ben White, look at my precious golden knuckle.
He'll have enough gold, right? Because if it's a golden glove that fits him, he's got the big hands, the famously big hands.
That's true, yeah. That's true.
The shovel hands. I loved that aspect of it. And although De Bezerbi said the game was over, well, it wasn't for us. Like you said, we had a number of shots in that last period and we got a third goal.
We did. Lovely finish from Leandro Trossard, sent through by Kai Havertz, slightly reminiscent of the goal we scored there last season, wasn't it? An Odegaard pass for Martinelli. Just put him in behind. You know, it's rare you see a player with the chance to run into that much space. But obviously the fact that Brighton were pushing forward and desperately trying to get something from the game, so they committed men forward. Trossard all the way through. There was a slight moment where I thought, oh, he's taking it on just a little too far. But that finish was lovely.
Yeah, I mentioned this in my post-match video, but I didn't have the best view of the screen. And when I saw this diminutive figure racing through on goal, I briefly thought it was Jorginho. And I was like, he's never going to make it. Help him. But fortunately, it was Trossard. And you don't see a lot of one-on-ones like this. I feel like I grew up on goals with players running in behind defences to score.
You don't
Thierry Henry, Nicolas Anelka. You know, but I think football's changed and there isn't necessarily that degree of space in behind defences all too often. But I enjoyed it. It was kind of a little bit retro, a little bit vintage and a lovely finish. I think I've said it many times. I think he's the best finisher at the club.
A lovely way to ice the cake. I think the game was already won at that point, but icing the cake in that way was very nice for Leandro Trossard, of course, against his former club. I enjoyed his post-game social media antics.
I've not seen that. What was
right,
that?
He just posted, you know, the way he stood there afterwards with his arms folded, just kind of looking. Where's the line between happy and smug?
Yeah, I'm watching his celebration now, and it's definitely a hint of evil to it. He's sort of like that. He might as well be cackling. I think he's masking a cackle as he puts it.
Well,
did he get a bit of stick off the Brighton fans?
I presume so. But his caption on social media was, "Are you not entertained?"
You know, he did them the respect of not doing his funny little eyes celebration, at least.
Oh, his binoculars.
He didn't do his little binoculars.
Didn't do his little binoculars. Know, yeah,
which I thought was very respectful of him.
Yeah, different celebration.
He did celebrate, but he didn't do his normal celebration. Are you happy with that, Brighton fans?
I don't think they were. But the ones that were there, the ones that were left in the ground.
Exactly. We are emptying stadiums all over the country.
So, you know, what more can we say about this as a performance? Because it did have potential banana skin. It did have a measure of jeopardy because of the quality of the opposition. I know they were missing some players and some big players who would probably have made life a bit more difficult for us. But, you know, we've gone through a lot of this season missing big players as well. And you have to be able to cope and do your best with what you have. But this, the quality, overall quality, the professionalism, the discipline, as you said at the start, a sort of business-like reaction to this, like, there is going to need to be some way of, I don't know, how do you keep focus, not get too excited, not get too nervous? You know, that is going to be a big part of what Mikel Arteta's got to do with this squad between now and the end of the season. And by the way, the end of the season is like 5 weeks. Is it 4 weeks? 5 weeks? You know, it's really not that far away. So it's going to be crazy and hectic and, you know, he's just got to keep everybody super, super focused on the games that we have.
It's 6 weeks or 8 weeks if we get to the Champions League final.
So 8 weeks then, okay.
Yeah. So it's actually, you know, we've got 8 weeks.
All right.
But yeah, it's just so intense. And I do think these three teams being in direct competition is going to push them all to greater lengths. You know, I think back to those titles where Liverpool pipped City or City pipped Liverpool. And, you know, they both ended up with quite extraordinary points tallies that in, you know, what you would call a normal campaign would make you champions. And I wonder where these three teams will end up, because every game feels must win.
Mm.
And although Liverpool have dropped points today, they're all playing really well and are in excellent form. So fascinating to see what goes on. I'm looking forward to seeing the updated Premier League title winner percentage chance stats from Opta and the like.
What is this?
I hate those stats.
I saw this. We had a question about this last week and I didn't quite understand. Someone had said there's like some kind of Opta supercomputer on the Sky coverage. Is that right?
Yeah, so basically, like, after every game, they'll be like, let's go to the Opta probability thing. And like, it will say, like, you know, Arsenal will have just won and you'll be feeling really good about it. And you're like, maybe we could do it. And then it will be like, Manchester City, likely title odds, 89%. Arsenal, 0.43 or something like that. Well, that's how it feels at any rate. And it's obviously calculated based on the team's performances, but also the fixtures they have to face and sort of likely outcomes. And it swings around all over the place according to the results. But yeah, genuinely, I'm a little bit curious to see what it will stand at now that Arsenal you know, almost have the league in their hands. I hate that. I'll never forgive those percentage odds calculator things for what happened last season, you know, where at one point we were like 50, 60% likely to win it. And then that number rapidly diminished.
Do you know, it's almost as if that kind of stuff is bollocks.
Andrew, it almost is.
Almost.
It almost is. But, you know, and like I say, they only ever serve to depress me. Either the numbers are so low for Arsenal that I'm like, this isn't what I want to read. Or when the numbers get good, I just get terrified that we're going to chuck it away. So
I'm better off without them. Don't look at the numbers. That would be my advice.
Yeah.
That would be my advice.
Or look at the points. They're the only numbers that count.
Exactly. Exactly.
And the goal difference.
That too. Look at those numbers over and over again. Shall we take a break?
Let's take a break.
And we'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with, thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. And just to remind you that if you do sign up, if you're already a member, this won't apply, but if you do sign up for Patreon in April, you'll get instant access to all the stuff that we do, and it's a busy, busy month because of all the football. But this month we are donating every single penny of our Patreon revenue to UNICEF to help children all around the world who are afflicted by war and conflict and disease. So every penny will go to an amazing cause. So if you want to sign up and help a good cause at the same time, it's patreon.com/arsblog. Right, James, seeing as you are far, far away, the other side of the Atlantic, and I want to take a little sip of my gin and tonic that I just went down to get, you can go first.
Gin and tonic on the Arscast.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's 20 to 7 on a Sunday evening. Nothing wrong with that.
The difference is working out for you.
Yeah, it's not, great. You know, you don't get a chance to do that, you know, at 10 a.m. on a Monday.
I mean, what are you talking about? I always have one at 10 a.m. on a Monday.
That explains a lot.
A couple of quick things before the questions. I've just seen on social media a quote from Jurgen Klopp.
Oh, yeah.
His post-match press conference. Have you seen this, where he was asked whether he thinks Arsenal will drop points at Old Trafford on May the 11th. And he said, "Arsenal is a good football team. And if Man United play like today, Arsenal will win that game." I'm 100% sure of that.
Yeah, yeah. Mind games, isn't it? Games.
I mean, you know, facts, I guess, if you know. But as we said, doesn't always follow logic. As Jurgen Klopp will know all too painfully. The other thing to say, by the way, is so obviously I'm here in Philly.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they've got a big supporters group out here, of which, you know, poorly drawn Arsenal is one. Mm-hmm. And yeah, big fan base out here. And I sort of mentioned to the supporters club, listen, I'm going to be in Philly for Brighton game. Because they've actually all just been over in London, weirdly, for Luton. I think a load of them came over for that game.
Right.
But I was like, I'm going to be in Philly for Brighton. And they were like, come down. We've got, you know, the Arsenal pub here. It's called the Misconduct Tavern.
The Misconduct Tavern.
Yeah. And I was like, and they gave me the address and whatever. I was like, great, can't wait. And I ran into someone, an Arsenal fan out here, Scott, and we decided we were going to go. And I just popped it in my phone, you know, popped it in City Mapper or Google, I can't remember, Misconduct Tavern, and arrived. And I was the only person in the pub, like 2 minutes before kickoff. I was like, that's weird.
Those fuckers, like, they tricked me. They've all gone somewhere else.
I was like, maybe there's a room. Like a special Arsenal room. So I like, you know, tried to go upstairs, downstairs, nothing. And then after kickoff, a few other Arsenal fans came in. We ended up watching the game together. And it was quite fun, actually. I actually watched the game with quite a well-known wrestler called Elton Prince.
Elton
so
Prince.
Wrestling fans here will be interested. What a name, by the way, Elton Prince. Next child's going to be called Elton Prince McNicholas Uchan. And anyway, so, you know, there's probably about a dozen fans and it was a nice atmosphere. And everybody, like, left me well alone. Like, no one came up and was like, hey, I'm from the Philly Supporters Club and nice to see you. And I was like, to be honest, that's nice. I respect that. You know, they've seen I'm here. Couple of mates, they're giving me some space and that's cool. And then at the end of the game at full time, I got a message on Twitter from Arsenal Philadelphia being like, I guess you didn't make it. No worries, maybe see you for the Bayern game. And I was like, I'm here. And then they were like, no, you're not. Anyway, as much as I thought the Misconduct Tavern sounded like a very unique name, turns out there are multiple Misconduct Taverns within Philadelphia.
What?
And I was at a branch, 15-minute walk from where I was supposed to be. And I was like, just send me a picture of where you are. And they sent me a picture of this pub, like, decked out in Arsenal regalia.
So it's like a chain of Misconduct Taverns.
It seems so. And so I had a lovely time, but very much in the wrong place. But I have a chance to redeem myself because I am here for the Bayern match. If you're in Philly, I'm going to be at a Misconduct Tavern.
Right. One of them. Tuesday. Take your pick. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to be in Philly in the summer as well. So I'll have to
choose your Misconduct Tavern wisely.
Yeah.
Andrew.
Well, I mean, there's an actual game in a stadium there, so it might be a little bit different, but I'm sure they'll have... they'll be having some fan events around the various Misconduct Taverns.
Yeah, I'm hoping to be back then as well. I've really enjoyed it. It's been a really fun time in the city. But yeah, I just thought that was funny. But listen.
Quite typical,
I say. Yes, and also, we won. Like, a lot of people will be like, you better go back to the same pub then, mate.
Yeah.
If that's the lucky pub for you to sit in.
Sit on the same stool, drink the same drink, eat the same bar snack.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. I will get round to a question now.
Okay.
If that's all right with you.
Fine.
Okay. How about this? We touched on this. I thought it was a really interesting question from Stedosaurus on Discord. And Stedosaurus said, Brighton continually tried to exploit Zinchenko with balls over the top to Adingra, yet didn't really get any chances from this. We didn't seem too worried, nor try to change anything. Do you think we were baiting them into a perceived weakness, which we weren't overly concerned about? Or were we just committed to having Zinchenko there to build his minutes or gain his on-the-ball play? With two defensive left-backs on the bench, there was no necessity to play him, so it must have been through choice.
Well, obviously, yeah, it was a choice to play him in this game. He played in the first game against Brighton earlier in the season, which was one of our best performances, even if the scoreline didn't quite reflect that, and Zinchenko played that day. You know, I know there was a moment, wasn't there, in the second half where he slightly misjudged the ball. It went for a corner. We dealt with the corner, and that was about it. Otherwise, I thought Zinchenko was absolutely fine and contributed to, you know, a very good Arsenal team performance. I suspect Brighton might have looked at him as a potential weak link. You know, if there is a weak link about him, it is defending, and it is probably a ball over the top or in behind. That's where he has been exposed a little bit during his time here. But like I said, after that first piece of play, which is about 9 minutes into the game, where they did a 1-2 beyond him, and it was, you know, I don't think it was anything particularly bad from Zinchenko. It was just, you know, if you commit to a tackle, you get bypassed like that, it leaves a lot of space. They did have that shot, but that was it. I don't think they got much joy down that side. Maybe Adingra had one shot, maybe about half an hour in the first half. And yeah, that was about it, you know? So I really feel like maybe you suggested some of the reaction is us leaning into some of the fears that we've had and some of the experiences we've had with Zinchenko during this season. But this wasn't a bad performance from him by any means. I do think the change was made at exactly the right time, though. You know, the Tomiyasu change in the second half, you know, as we decided to sit in and decided to just snuff Brighton out, Zinchenko is not a player to do that. That's not what he does. Whereas Tomiyasu absolutely is, and I think it was the right time to do it. So,
yeah. I think that was a really interesting question, because I find it fascinating, that idea that you're kind of baiting a team into doing something, because ultimately, there's no way Arteta and the coaching staff don't already know that teams are going to look to attack the space in behind Zinchenko, right? They know that going in. They know that every time they pick him. So I do wonder if there's an extent to which they're like, well, if you're going to do that, you've got to beat Gabriel in that left side channel, because effectively we're going to be playing with a back three and he's going to be mopping everything up in that part of the pitch. And if you do that and commit those players forward on that right-hand side, guess what? You're leaving Gabriel Jesus or Gabriel Martinelli one-on-one. So, you know, I find that really, really interesting. There are weaknesses in all teams, in all formations, and sometimes you know that's what your opponent's going to look to exploit, but you can maybe make that work to your advantage. It's a game of chess, right? We've spoken about Zinchenko and chess many times before, but yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. Maybe there is something to it. You know, I talked about the risk reward approach you have to take against Brighton.
Exactly.
And that could have been part of it, in fairness.
Just to follow on from that, Varun on Twitter said, with all three of our current left back options having had enough time now to build up match fitness and sharpness, who do you feel is the best option for our match against Bayern this week?
Tomiyasu.
I agree.
We had another question. I think I had one here as well. Boom, 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 boom. Let me see. It comes from Martinelli the Elephant. Martinelli the Elephant.
I like that.
Who says, what's your thoughts on Kivior going from starting regularly all throughout our post-Dubai run to not making an appearance in the last couple of games? Is it rest, tactical, or a slipping down the pecking order? I think this is an interesting question as well.
Yeah, it is interesting, because that back four with him in it performed really admirably, didn't it? Including at Manchester City, getting a clean sheet there. I don't quite know, to be honest with you, what it means. I don't think it's about rest or fitness, especially. I think it's kind of pecking orders and hierarchies maybe being slightly restored. I think as well as Kivior has done, I don't think Arteta, I don't think he fits the mold of what Arteta wants from his fullback as much as the other options. I think that's what is happening here. What do you think?
I tend to agree with that. But I think sometimes we look for bigger meaning in things than actually exists.
Mm.
Like, we needed Jakub Kiwior to come in and do a job for us for a certain period of time in the season. And he did it very well. And we now have Zinchenko fit again. We now have Tomiyasu hopefully fit again. We may have Timber back soon. Who knows? And I think this is the sort of essence of a squad player, which Kiwior is. And it's not to denigrate him or suggest he's not important, because the job he's done over the last little while is really important. I think there might be games where he's perfect, you know, to start, and maybe even as a closer as well, you know? But I don't know that there's anything more to it than, right, we have other options at this moment in time. We have other options who can help us play a bit differently at this moment in time. And in order to, like, in order to win some of the games that we've needed to win in the last week or so, I'm not saying we couldn't have won them with Kiwior. Of course we could. But I do think the structure of the team with Kiwior in it is slightly different than it is with Zinchenko, and maybe even with Tomiyasu. So I think, you know, let's not worry too much about him either slipping down the pecking order or whatever it might be. Let's appreciate the really good job that he did for us at a crucial part in the season. And it leaves us in a position where we can feel confident that if we need him again, he can come in and do a good job.
Yeah. And frankly, if he has now kind of made his major contribution for the season, I don't think it'll be forgotten.
No.
Because he was incredibly important at a time when we had three left backs out injured for various reasons.
Mm.
You know, to pull back the curtain a bit, it's interesting. I had a conversation at work with The Athletic. I think it was around the City game. You know, they were kind of saying to me, the editorial team, Kiwior, you know, your average Premier League fan doesn't know a ton about Kiwior. It'd be interesting to kind of do a feature on him, who he is and everything like that. And I did say to them, like, yeah, I think that would be really interesting, and I'm sure we will do it. But we may have missed the boat. Like, my hunch is that he has kind of had his moment in the season, and if players stay fit, his role might be fairly peripheral moving forward. I sort of suspected that as soon as Tomiyasu got close to being fully fit. You know, I expected him to go ahead of Kiwior in the pecking order, because I think Brighton was sort of a good example of a game where you want a fullback at certain times because of what they give you on the ball, and then in the last stages of the game, you want a fullback because of what they give you defensively.
Yeah.
And I think the reality for Kiwior is Zinchenko is better than him for the former, and I think Tomiyasu is better than him for the latter.
Mm-hmm.
So it does leave him, you know, in a slightly awkward position. But he's not really here to play fullback. You know, he is here predominantly as a centre-half. But I think we all probably hope he doesn't get that chance.
Yeah,
now and
with all due respect to him, I hope, you know, that isn't the case, that he's not needed. Gabriel, of course, took a fairly heavy kick at one point in the game, and it was a little bit worrying. Mm-hmm. Had a question about him from Master John Bree, who said, "Goodly morning." Well, no, it's not. It's evening now, but it can still be goodly. He says, "Should Gabriel Magalhães win Premier League Player of the Year if we win the league? He's been incredible all season, both defensively and offensively." And I don't know. I think we all appreciate him, and we all really connect with the way he defends and the, like, just how much he enjoys stopping the opposition, as we talked about in the first half, you know, those kinds of things. Fans love that. You love to see that from your defenders. Is he always going to be slightly underappreciated, though?
I mean, the toughest thing is he plays next to William Saliba.
I mean, I saw Saliba do a couple of things in this game that if a number 10 did them, you'd be like, oh my God. That guy, how does he have the the cool head and the technical ability and the quick feet in order to do that. And it's one thing doing those things, you know, 5-10 yards outside the opposition box. It's another thing entirely doing them inside your own. And there's a fine line between genius and madness, isn't there? But it was more genius than anything else. Some of the stuff Saliba does is just like, I can't believe that.
It's tough, you know, being in somebody's shadow. You know, they've got such a lovely, rich voice, an Irish accent. They can make jingles. You know, you're never going to quite get the credit. Maybe that you deserve because you're overshadowed. But, you know, PFA Player of the Year, I don't know, right? I hope whoever gets that. The problem is they're voting for that, I think, right now. So I think in an ideal world, the winner would come from the champions, right? It's been such a good title race.
Mm.
You'd want the winner to be the player who kind of decides the league. I think Gabriel, you know, when they do the Arsenal Player of the Year, there's normally like a top three. And I think he'll be in it.
See, I don't.
Do not?
No. Like, I'm not saying he wouldn't deserve it. It really is hard to pick.
Rice will be in it.
Saka will be in it. Ben White could be in there. Odegaard could be in there. You know, Havertz is making a late gallop towards the finishing line on that as well.
Saka's the one. He's always going to get a lot of votes because he's Bukayo Saka. But yeah, for me, Rice, Odegaard, Saka, Gabriel. They're the four that jump out to me.
And Saliba, no, or not Saliba? Or
Saliba, yeah. I think Gabriel has been...
As good? Difficult. I mean,
He's been the better.
Right.
I think he's been better. For me, this season, last season I thought Saliba was better than Gabriel. I think for me, this season, Gabriel has been our outstanding defender, honestly. I know Saliba's more talented. I'm sure of that. He's got more technical ability.
Mm-hmm.
He's got more natural gifts. But I think as a defender, maturity is really valuable. And I think we're watching a mature Gabriel right now. A player who's still emotional, who still feels the game, who still plays with fire, but exhibits a bit more
control.
Control.
A more mature defender, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I just think he's been brilliant, honestly. Like,
I agree.
I know they've all been good, but yeah, I don't think he's ever going to win the big prizes as an individual. I think it's hard, isn't it, as a centre-back?
Yeah.
Even if you're the top-scoring centre-back of the last, 3 years or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's hard. And if Liverpool win it, then a lot of people will say Van Dijk. He's been their outstanding player this season, arguably. Mm. And he's more in that Saliba mold where, he's kind of a Rolls Royce. If Saliba's a Rolls Royce, what does that make Gabriel? A monster truck?
Yeah, something like
but
that.
I like a monster truck centre half,
Yeah, just, crushing the opposition with his giant wheels.
If nothing else, he's at least got a song at long last.
Well, there you go. That'll be his consolation. I think he has been brilliant. I agree with you. I think he's been absolutely outstanding. The consistency, and I think the point you make about the way he plays the game is emotional. He is desperate to win all the time. And I think there have been moments in the past where that has boiled over just a little bit. But the maturity, the discipline, the understanding of the game that he has right now. And I think, we've got two players who absolutely dovetail off each other. Like, I don't think Gabriel...
It's absurdity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The individual rewards in some respect.
Yeah.
Because if there were ever two players who should be sharing a prize, it's Saliba and Gabriel, Ice and fire, aren't they? And a perfectly dovetailed partnership.
Well, that's it. I don't think Gabriel would be as good without Saliba. I don't think Saliba would be as good without Gabriel. They're like conjoined twins.
What did you make of Arteta's little gag about Saliba the other day? Did you see it when he was like, when did you know? Someone asked him, when did you know that Saliba would make such a good partner for Gabriel.
Oh, he said, when I sent him to Marseille.
He said, when I decided with the club to send him to Marseille. Yeah. Was that like a little bit of self-deprecation from Mikel?
Maybe. It could have been a little bit of, you know, I think we get the idea that Mikel Arteta is completely detached and unaware of what people say about some of the decisions he makes. Mm. And I would say at that period, you know, it wasn't this was the things were difficult during that period, right? That was when you could easily have made a very good case that for all the benefits that Saliba got and Arsenal got ultimately from him being on loan at Marseille and playing every week, you know, you could also have made the point and made the case that, well, Arsenal could have used him in that season. Yeah. They could really have used him and he would have played, you know, a certain amount of football, but maybe ultimately it was the best thing for him. But I think it was probably just a throwaway gag from Arteta who was probably aware of what some people were saying about that decision at the time.
Yeah. I mean, for my money, I think it would be out of character for Mikel to sort of admit this, but I don't think he foresaw Saliba being the player he has become at Arsenal. But yeah, thank God things worked out the way they did.
Mm. I think it's your question.
Right. Let's have a look at this one. The Land 5185 says, goodly insert time of day, gentlemen. I appreciate that. Do you ever just take a step back from the stress of results and wanting to win things and think, wow, our team really is that team again? Should you?
Should I? Absolutely.
Right.
And actually, I think it's so difficult when you get to this point of the season where tangible success is so close that if it doesn't happen, it is going to hurt. It's going to be so painful because I think we can all recognize we've got the quality to go toe-to-toe with the two big teams and win this league. So if we don't get there, it will be painful and disappointing and frustrating because, you know, we all want it so much. But can I recognize that this is a really, really impressive Arsenal team, that the job that Arsenal Football Club have done to rebuild the team from where it was is outstanding, you know, from Arteta to Edu to, you know, the board, the way they have backed the manager, and it's been so, so impressive. It's hard, isn't it, you know, if it doesn't go your way to say, well, that was a successful season, but success can also be progress, even if it doesn't end up in silverware. And I'm not saying I don't want to see silverware. Of course I do. That would be the ultimate success from this season. But, I can recognize that this Arsenal team is enjoyable to watch. Like I said, after we went 2-0 up, I was comfortable. Haven't always been comfortable. Wasn't even that comfortable in the Luton game, you know, at 2-0, because I was slightly worried about that sucker punch situation. But in this game, I really was. I like the team. I like the players. I like the way they play. I like the commitment. I like the fact you don't look at someone shirking their responsibilities. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, and I think one of the things I've always said is that if I can see an Arsenal team that is committed, doing its best, trying its hardest, there aren't people going through the motions, there aren't people taking the piss, there aren't people just, you know, coasting because they've got a big contract or they've come in on a free transfer and they can just sort of arse around. You know, if I can see guys who are really trying their best and they don't get there right at the death, I can live with that. It's not that it won't hurt me, but I can live with that much more easily than what we've seen in some of the seasons in the past.
Yeah. I think, and you'll have the right to quote me on this when I'm in tears on the final day when we're pipped at the post, but I think I'll cope pretty well with us. If we're beaten to it this year, I kind of think so be it. Like, if what I want is for us to maintain our level of performance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want us to just fall away and for the good performances to suddenly feel like a mirage, because as what happened last season, we suddenly look like a mid-table team out mm-hmm. of nowhere. You know, I don't expect us to win every game, but if we win, you know, 75% of our games and play well until the end of the season and somebody beats us, you know, by a point or 2 points, it'll be frustrating, it'll be galling, but I will also say, I'll have to take my hat off to them, right? Chapeau, as Mikel might say, because they'll have done something extraordinary and beaten an exceptional team to winning the league. And I think that sort of having never really had it in our hands this season, I just don't think the levels of pain and trauma can possibly match what it was like 12 months ago. And I think part of my sort of calmness about it all comes from the fact that having delivered this second consecutive title challenge and looking at the evolution of the team and the coach, who I think is also improving in front of our eyes, and that's something we don't speak about often enough, I think we're just incredibly well set up for the next few years. Like, if it's not this season, it's gonna be next season or the season after. Like,
I mean,
our time is coming. I feel that.
Yes,
for sure.
100%. I remember last season there were people saying, "Well, this is it. This is your chance.
Yeah.
It's the only chance you're going to get." And part of why I was able to cope with the way last season ended up was I did not believe that for a second. I did not believe that this was our one and only chance, because you could see the progression of the team, the manager, all of it. And I felt confident that we could challenge again this season. And we have, and we are. And I feel confident that we will challenge again next season too. Because I don't think that this is a club or a manager right now that is prepared to rest on its laurels in any way. Whether we win it this season or not, they will not rest on their laurels. It won't. If we win it, it'll be fucking amazing. But then the next day, I guarantee you Mikel Arteta will be talking about, how do we improve? How do we get better? How do we make it more difficult for anyone to beat us next season? How do we score more goals next season? And I think that is the mindset which gives me the confidence that if it isn't this year, it will be another year and probably next year.
Yeah, I from where I'm stood, we look incredibly well positioned. I almost think we might go into next year as favourites. Based on the way we're playing now and based on certain things about the other clubs and their trajectories, you know, I think we'll look really strong. But listen, I'd love it to be this year. Don't get me wrong.
Let's keep fingers crossed. Here's a question I did sort of talk about in the first half of the season. It comes from Tola on the Discord. He says, "Goodly morning, gents. Arteta's post-match words seem to make it clear that he's now seeing Havertz as a quality centre forward when he was obviously brought in as a midfielder." See Arteta's words when we signed him. Interested in on your thoughts as to whether you think this will, or if this means his time at eight is pretty much over, and whether you think this will change our transfer strategy in the summer.
Well, we spoke about this, didn't we, in part one a little bit. Is it over? I would say no. You know, the midfield experiment is not over. I think there are times when we will see it. I can see it maybe in the last 20 minutes of games at times, and I think there'll be occasions. But I can't see anyone shifting Havertz from that number nine spot between now and the end of the season. I think he's made it his own.
Mm.
And I think it does change, cast a bit of a different light on what we could and should do in the summer. You know, if you think back to pre-Christmas and January, all the talk was the missing piece for Arsenal is a number nine.
Mm.
And now I wonder if you had to say, right, if you had to say this one position, would you still say number nine? Or would you say central midfield?
Yeah. I think...
Yeah.
I think I would say, at this point, central midfield. That left eight, you know, that player who's not quite nailed on, but pretty obviously the guy in there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, there's also a sort of secondary conversation, which is like, do you have to decide what you want to do with Declan Rice? Is he that guy? If you're keeping Jorginho around, does that have an influence? It's interesting because, yeah, Jorginho's out of contract in a few months. I know that there, you know,
yeah,
there certainly was an option in the deal. But
there have been some noises, haven't there, about, you know, him going back to Italy and things like that. Maybe Arsenal will push the boat out and give him a 2-year deal, whatever it is that he wants. But, you know, sailing a little close to the wind,
to be honest. No, and I don't think he should have to.
No, I agree. I don't think he should. At this point in his career, he wants a little bit of security. I think he's been a good signing for Arsenal. A good signing for the price that we paid for him. I know, like, he's not going to be a 38-game a season guy in the Premier League, but I think he's been a really good signing.
Yeah, I mean, not many people would have had him in their best 11 last summer, you know, and he's done that, you know, through his performances. So I'm full of admiration for him. But, yeah, I tend to think a really able, on the ball, left eight to kind of complement Odegaard and Rice, I think that could be the biggest difference maker for Arsenal. I think, which is a big turnaround, you know, from everyone saying it's a nine.
I mean, it could be, you know, we could bring in a nine and an eight. Who knows? Well,
I think we should, because I think there's going to be room in the squad for a striker. I feel certain that Eddie, his time with the club will come to an end. Certain's a big word, but I feel confident that that's what will happen. And yeah, I think we could do with both, and it put us in an even stronger position. I just wonder if it, you know, again, we've been saying this for months now, but I think it does mean that we're not going to see Arsenal buy a striker for 150 million quid.
No.
I don't think that would be the wisest allocation of resource right now.
No, I don't think that's going to happen either. So, yeah, it will be fascinating to see what happens. Maybe the last few games of the season will tell us what we need as well. You know, things can change. So,
Can I ask you a sort of straight question then?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Kai Havertz, what he's producing right now, do you think he's good enough to be our starting nine next season?
What he's producing now?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, he's producing a lot right now.
He is.
I would still like to have another...
So would I.
Option is what I would say, I suppose.
I think I would too. I think, you know, what they think Gabriel Jesus is capable of.
Yeah.
Might play a part in this. I think a lot of people are looking at the summer and saying, well, probably Eddie will go because he's not really playing and he might want to play regularly. So there's room for another striker. But maybe there's room for another forward, you know? That's the other side of it. Could it be a winger? Could it be somebody to give the forward line something it doesn't quite have in terms of pace? I don't know. But I would feel like... I like what Havertz is doing, but... You know, maybe I could look back on this in 12 months' time and have egg on my face. I'm just not necessarily convinced that he is the guy to lead the line for a team like Arsenal. I mean, that sounds so fucking dumb, actually, now that I say it, given that he's leading the line and we're top of the table and we've scored more goals than anyone else and he's just put in a performance like he's put in. But
I think it's fine to say that it's just too early to know.
Yeah, maybe that's the right way to go about it. Maybe that's like, the right way.
You know, that's the thing about it's a bit of a flawed question. Because, yeah, if he keeps playing like he is now, of course he's good enough. But the mark of great players is being consistent over long periods. Mm. And we don't know that he can do that. But you remember, we had a question a couple of weeks ago about, you know, Havertz, Trossard and Jesus. If you want to play with like a number nine who links play and drops deep and does all sorts of things, you won't find many better trios than that.
No.
So it's an interesting one. It's a really interesting one.
Speaking of players who produce consistently, Rome in the Home asks, at the moment, Martin Odegaard is basically playing every minute of every game. As we reach crunch time, how do you feel his stamina is going to hold up? Who would you like to see him job share with, or is he too integral to Arteta ball?
There's no replacement in the squad for him. That's for sure. I don't think we've got anyone who's close in terms of what he offers on and off the ball. And I have seen him. I think it was at the Etihad. I saw him in those last 10 minutes and I thought, I've not often seen Martin Odegaard tired. And that was a very particular game with a very particular task and a lot of running. But I saw him look ragged and I saw people run away from him. And I thought, you know, it takes a lot because he's super, super, super fit. I think he's just going to push through. Because I don't see, you know, even when we rotated against Luton, he was in there, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. I think he's just so integral. I can't envisage a lineup really where you can properly compensate for what he brings. And when you're the club captain and when you're the star man, what does Mikel say? You play a lot of games.
Play every 3 days.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think?
I completely agree with you. There is nobody who can come in and do what he does. I think there are guys who could do an impression of it, but I think Odegaard's importance as the leader of the press, the way we're organized, I think his performances are just unbelievably consistent. The lead by example nature of the way he plays, you know, he is fundamental to this team as much as Gabriel and William Saliba and Declan Rice are. And even Declan Rice was able to get a night off against Luton.
Yeah.
Because there are people who can pretty much do what he does. Maybe not as well, but the drop-off isn't as big. Whereas I think, like, who are the potential Odegaard replacements? Fabio Vieira?
Well, they've all got a bit of baggage, that's the thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're all guys with question marks over them.
Mm.
It's Vieira. It's Smith Rowe.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I think,
I guess at a push, it's Havertz.
Yeah, Havertz did play a little bit there, but I think, you know, we've just spoken about how important he is. But I mean, you could, but it would be completely different. You know, there's no way Havertz could do the on the ball work that Odegaard does. Right?
No, exactly.
You know, I think Havertz is much better receiving the ball higher up the pitch than trying to do something with the ball midway in the opposition half.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think maybe the closest facsimile for me would be Smith Rowe, because he has played there a little bit in his time. Yeah. He is a different kind of player from Odegaard, but he would be the one I would go to if, you know, a change had to be made. But I think, as you just said, he will be pushed through, or he will push through, and maybe the opportunity to give him any kind of time off or rest will come if we are dominant in games and if we're in a position to do that. You know, if we're 3-0 up against Aston Villa, 4-0 up against Aston Villa, I'm not saying that's going to happen easily, of course, but if we are, then you can feel confident about giving Martin Odegaard 20 minutes off. But if it's 1-1, there's 20 minutes left, there's no way you're taking that guy off. Nope. He's unbelievable, though. I have to say, he's just such a fucking amazing player. And it will go down, I think, as one of the bargains of all time.
Mm.
You know, what we paid for him. Unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. He is. He's as important to this team as any great player that you can think of for any of the best teams. You know, he's as important to us as Van Dijk is to Liverpool. I know their roles are different, but, you know, as Messi was to Barcelona, as, you know, Wayne Rooney would have been to Manchester, he is that guy. His quality is such and his consistency is such that, you know, he's got to be a first name on the team sheet.
And he cost half what Van Dijk cost.
Yeah.
One wild card for that position, I guess, if you were trying to think out the box a bit, could be a Trossard.
No, maybe. Not for me.
Not for you?
No, no.
He's played in midfield, though, hasn't he, for us once or twice?
Yeah, and he's done okay, but I don't...
From the left-hand side. Yeah, I like I said, I don't think there's anyone who can rival what Odegaard brings in that position.
No, I don't think so either.
Just pray for him, basically.
Yes, but I think I think this is... this is a challenge that he's absolutely relishing. You know, when you hear him talk, he did an interview with Rog from Men in Blazers ahead of the game against Brighton, you know, and he's talking about the maturity and how much the team is working and how much they've learned from last season. And, you know, the proof will be, you know, mid-May. Have they learned enough? We'll wait and see. But I think he's desperate. I think he's absolutely desperate to lead this team to the success that we all want, and that will see him, you know, dig deep into the reserves that he has, because I think he's that kind of character as well. As you said, you very rarely see him tired, and nobody runs more. Not a single player in this team, beyond maybe Ben White running up and down, runs more than Martin Odegaard, because Odegaard leads the press, he chases back, he's every Arsenal player should be inspired by the way that he plays and performs. So
I agree, man.
All right. Look, I think we should leave it there, because, you know, you've got a whole day of, you know, oiled up men.
I got to watch all these muscly men cuddle each other.
Lovely. Sounds like a fun time. So we will let you go and do that and have a Philly cheesesteak, which I'm sure you've had already. Have you?
I haven't actually sampled one.
Come on.
If anyone has recommendations for the best place, let me know, because there's a lot of discrepancy.
Yeah. You know, everyone's going to be like, you got to go to Paulie's.
You got to go to Joe's. Exactly. Yeah. Let me know. Is it Joe's or Paulie's?
Inundate Gunnerblog's Twitter mentions, please, with where he's got to go for a Philly cheesesteak.
Genuinely, this is true. I don't eat beef because it gives me really bad stomachache, but I'm going to break that because I have to eat a cheesesteak. So if I'm going to suffer this stomachache, I want to get it right.
Right. This is the sacrifice that he is willing to make.
I'm a noble man, Andrew.
You are. You are.
When will I step out of your shadow and receive my flowers?
The underappreciated James McNicholas tour of the US continues apace. Well, listen, enjoy all that. Enjoy the cheesesteak. Enjoy the bathroom breaks that you're probably going to have to take in the stadium this evening as Macho Man Randy Savage does his thing. Oh, he's gone, isn't he?
But I hope not.
Well, he's dead, isn't he?
Is he? Yeah.
I think so.
Well, then I definitely hope not.
Sorry, Macho Man. Please do join us on Patreon tomorrow. We're going to have an episode of The 30, looking back at all the weekend's Premier League action. Oh, what are the latest scores? Are there any interesting scores? Did we look? Let me have a look. Live score.
Spurs 3-1 up against Forest.
For fuck's sake.
But Chelsea pegged back to 2-2 in stoppage time at Sheffield United.
Get out of here. No way. Ollie McBurney. Phil's going to have a field day with that one. So we'll have an episode of The 30 for you. We'll also be previewing the Bayern Munich game, which, of course, is taking place on Tuesday. So we'll have our preview podcast as well on Patreon, patreon.com/arseblog. For now, take it easy, and we'll talk soon. We'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers.
Bye-bye.